This meeting of the House Energy Committee will now come to order. The time is 1:03 p.m. on Thursday, March 13th. Members present are Representative Costello, Representative Edgman, Representative Rauscher, Representative Kopp, Co-Chair Holland, and myself, Representative Mears. We have a quorum to connect business. I'd like to remind members to please silence your cell phones, something that I failed to do a couple of weeks ago, so we'll help remind others. A reminder that if you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Ariel Svetlik, and she will take care of it. Importantly, I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole, the House Energy Committee Secretary, and Zach Lawhorn from the Juno LIO for tech and teleconferencing support. Today, the committee will hear from applicants to the Renewable Energy Fund. I am looking forward to this conversation. We've talked about the REF in this committee and having some more specifics on some of the projects. I'm really looking forward to that. So thank you for everyone here today for that. We have Connor Erickson, Director of Planning of the Alaska Energy Authority, on the line to assist with any questions about the program throughout today's presentations. With that, our first presenter is Robert Seidman, PE, Chief Executive Officer of Southeast Alaska Power Agency. Please approach the bench, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Excellent. For the record, my name is Robert Seidman, Chief Executive Officer of Southeast Alaska Power Agency. I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity and SEPA the opportunity to present a project on the Renewable Energy Fund list. When we take a look here, can you guys see this presentation on your screens in front of you? Because
yeah.
There's going to be some animations, and I'd like you to see that. What you're seeing in this is a submarine cable that we installed about 4 years ago between Wrangell, Alaska, and Petersburg, Alaska. So in Southeast Alaska, we're all on islands. And so we have transmission lines, but in order to get island to island, we have to go underwater. And so we have underwater power lines. And this is an example of a project that we installed in 2021. I want to start with going a little bit into about SEPA and who we are. We service three communities in Southeast Alaska, the communities of Petersburg, Wrangell, and Ketchikan. We do that by way of two hydroelectric facilities. Those facilities are the Tyee Lake facility and the Swan Lake facility. 175 miles of transmission lines connects Petersburg all the way to Ketchikan through each one of those hydroelectric facilities. And as I mentioned in the first slide, we got about 12 miles of submarine cables. Additionally, we, on average, produce about 180 gigawatt hours per year. And a couple fun facts about SEPA. The electric grid down in southern southeast is the second actual largest electric transmission system in Alaska. That's 69 kV and above. Another fun fact is Tyee Lake is the third highest yield hydro in Alaska. And what I mean by yield is energy-wise, the amount of potential energy within the lake in any given year. Next slide.
Pause for a moment. I'd like to recognize that Representative Tilton has joined us at 1:04 p.m.
Thank you.
Continue.
Next slide. A little bit further about SEPA. You can see a picture there. The previous slide showed a picture of the Tyee Lake. And then this slide shows you a picture of the Swan Lake facility. Swan Lake is a arched dam, and we'll be able to see it in the following slide. This just demonstrates in the past. We have been 100% renewable 99% of the time. However, those times may change here in the future, and I'll get into that as we go through load growth and what we're seeing in Southeast in terms of energy. Next slide is a trend analysis. This slide demonstrates a year in the life of SEPA in the year 2022. What you'll see here in the blue is the SEPA megawatt outputs per month. How many megawatt hours did we produce in 2022 from January through December? What you'll see in orange is the amount of spilled energy. So typically, SEPA has about approximately 200 gigawatt hours of potential energy. We dispatch about 180 gigawatt hours of that. In 2022, you'll see that we We actually lost about 36 gigawatt hours of energy due to spill, which is there was more rain than usage that year. The average spill for SEPA is between 20 gigawatt hours to 30 gigawatt hours per year. So when we talk about energy and capacity, we're talking about energy here. How much can we provide throughout a certain given period of time? We're not talking about capacity, and that's how much can we give at any moment. When we get to the next slide, we'll talk about capacity. Trend analysis for SEPA's system in 2022, you'll see on this slide that January all the way through December, what was our peak megawatts for each month? This illustration shows that our peaking capacity at Southeast Alaska Power Agency is about 48 megawatts. It's also proportional to lake levels, which means as the lakes lower, that 48 megawatts actually lowers for our peaking capacity. In 2022, we needed 63 megawatts. So there was the difference between the two that was required for diesel generation. So what you're seeing here is from the previous slide, you see the orange was spill, and in the next slide, we still had to generate with diesels. So we had all the energy we needed. We just didn't have enough capacity. Next slide shows you load growth. In 2023, we did a load growth study. Load growth really has been driven by heat pump conversions. The load growth study showed they forecasted about 2.5% increase year over year. However, in 2024, we saw 5%. This is mainly due to the heat pump conversions that are currently occurring in Southeast Alaska. And I'll get into that a little bit here later. The load growth study also takes into account potential dock electrification in southern Southeast Alaska and electric vehicles and the penetration from those technologies. This project, number 11 on the Renewable Energy Fund list, would raise that existing capacity limit from 48 megawatts to 60 megawatts, and that's about 16,000 horsepower. So the next slide goes into why. Why are we seeing load growth in Southeast? And really, it comes down to the cost of energy. 70 to 80% of the residents in Southeast, or 70 to 80% of residential energy consumption pretty much in all of Alaska is for heating. When we talk about electric bills and other things, if we combine all the energy costs of a home, 70 to 80% of those costs are for heating. In 2016, the Southeast Conference did a study. They found out that 72% of the homes in Alaska, Southeast Alaska, were heated with fuel oil. That's diesel. In 2023, when SEPA did a load growth study, we found that the percentage had dropped to 50%. So about 22% of the homes converted from diesel oil heating to electric in the form of that either heat pumps or electric baseboard or some type of electric. When we look at a cost comparison and the reason for those conversions, and they're happening by attrition, is we look at different communities. If we take, for example, Anchorage, one therm of heat, which is 100,000 BTUs of natural gas, is about $1.06. And this is what I got from NSTAR's website, so I may be wrong, but that's what I got from the website there. If you compare that to Ketchikan, for example, one therm of heat, which is 100,000 BTUs, a fuel oil costs the residents in Ketchikan $3.24. That's about 305% increase over the cost of energy for heating in Anchorage. One interesting fact about Southeast is we don't receive power cost equalization. So that burden is completely on the backs of every one of the ratepayers.
I think it's a clarification, but might be a question. So the overall energy demand picture isn't really changing, but there's a conversion. People are wanting to get off of imported energy, in this case diesel, into a local energy source, which is hydro for electricity. So it's that conversion from importing energy to using what you've got.
Correct. And what you'll see is the rate of growth for the peaking, the capacity, is far outweighing the rate of growth of the energy. So we're not seeing more homes and more energy usage. We're seeing a conversion, as you mentioned, from one type of energy sector to another. It really comes down to the cost, as I mentioned in that last slide. 305% is quite a bit, quite a bit of a difference. Looking at trend analysis for diesel heating, this is kind of a chart. This is a chart that came from our 2023 load study. In 2021, Petersburg, Wrangell, and Ketchikan combined burned about 3.87 million gallons of diesel to heat residential homes. And in 2022, that dropped to about 3.68. It might not seem like much, but it's about 5%. The 3.7 million gallons cost the ratepayers or the residents of Southeast $18.5 million. And that's at $5 a gallon. That's what it was in 2022. Heat pump equivalent cost per displaced gallon is approximately $1.90 at $5 a gallon. So by converting to heat pumps, if we were to convert the remaining 3.7 million gallons, it would save about $11.5 million a year for residents in Southern Southeast. Question. What's being escalated right now, this has been happening by attrition. So folks are making these conversions because it's cheaper. But there is a $38 million heat pump grant that will accelerate this, that the Southeast Conference, if the federal government unfreezes it, will receive those funds, and that will accelerate this load growth that we've been seeing.
We have a question from Co-Chair Holland.
Thanks. Through the chair, and maybe you'll get into this a little bit further, but I think this is a place where I at least want to tee up this question. Looking at the savings that you're showing here as you convert from diesel over to heat pumps, I'm curious how those savings are being used or could be used to help finance some of the additional generation capacity that you're looking for and or some of the heat pump conversions. It seems like a pretty good cash flow of savings here, and I'm wondering how that factors into these projects. And, of course, I'm thinking of the REF grant you're looking for and saying, well, this looks like there's a pretty good cash flow to fund some of these projects anyway. How does this savings translate into helping finance some of the projects, either on the production side or on the heat pump installation side?
Through the chair, that question really comes down to whether or not the 305% is something that we want to convert to additional rate increases. So in order to capture that savings, that's per residential savings. That's not to SEPA. Mm-hmm. That's per home. So if we're going to capture that in terms of applying it to a renewable energy fund, we would have to raise the rates on the electric system. Right now, we're already seeing population decline because the cost of living in Southeast is so high. Not only we all know that the cost per homes are significantly high, but also the energy costs. My last month's electric bill or gas bill or diesel was $600, and that was before I got electric in there. And I got a very modest, small 3-bedroom, 2-bath home. So that's quite expensive, and most folks are, you know, feeling that. And with other inflationary cost increases, we are seeing actual decline of populations. So if I were to raise rates to try and fund the renewable energy fund as a cost savings, if you will, those folks that have not converted would be punished. Those that did convert would probably feel okay, but our population probably would still be declining because we would be raising the cost of base energy, energy costs, which is fundamental to the economics of almost every community.
Well, thanks.
So I think we're going to get into the economics of the proposed project a little bit later, but we're also, timing is important to initial capital for construction of like a hydro project, which has got high initial capital, is very different than as you're going, you know, with rates as you go along. So front loading some of that makes some of these high capital projects possible. But we'll get into the economics later, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Please proceed.
Thank you. The next page is for engineers and nerds like me. You've got calculations here that show you what the heat pump efficiencies and units and then calculation on the right side of that slide shows you what 3.7 million gallons would convert into megawatt hours. So if we were to convert all the oil-based heating systems in southern southeast Alaska, it would equate to about 36 gigawatt hours. And coincidentally, as we've seen in 2022, that's right about where we spilled. So right now we have enough fuel in the tank to make the conversion. This project is trying to build the horsepower up so that we can deliver that energy.
Quick question, I think.
A question from Coacher Holland.
Great, thanks. I just want to, on the spill issue and the capacity, I just want to clarify. When I look back at the slide showing the spilled energy, which looked like was September, October, a little bit of November, and then I look at the next slide on where you end up needing to use diesel to make up for the gap in supply, that appears to be December. Do you have the storage capacity to have saved what was spilled in October so that you can run it through new turbines in December?
Yeah, through the chair. So that's a good question. And our water cycle is definitely cyclical. So when we go to spill, that is you either start the water cycle at your full low lake level, or you say the water cycle starts at the end of the spill level. So, but that being said, it goes from spill to spill or low to low. So any consumption in between those times would directly impact whether or not you're going to spill the following year. So the diesel that was burned after the spill of this year would prevent the spill for next year. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Thank you for the clarification. I was just trying to add it up, but I wasn't thinking in multiple year spill cycles, and that's a huge insight. Thanks.
Absolutely. May I continue?
Please continue.
Right. Excellent. Thank you. So moving on to the actual project, what the future holds and how SEPA is trying to make sure that the conversions that the folks are doing from oil to heat pumps, that we don't have to burn diesel to replace diesel, because we get a lot of efficiency loss in doing so, and the cost of diesel operations in southern southeast is approximately 10 times that of hydro. So in 1984, the Tidy Lake facility was built with provisions for another generator. It has two existing generators, but it has a skeleton bay that we can install a third generator at. This third generator would increase the capacity at the facility by 50%. This would also additionally increase the total capacity of the SEPA system by 25%. Additional benefits include contingency and resiliency. So contingency in the summer and all the months when we have lower loads, if we have a failure on a generator, we don't have to all immediately go on to diesel. And then for the 4 months to 6 months of the year where we need all three of the generators, we would have them. It also increases resiliency because you've got the more generators you have on a grid, the stiffer, they call it, of the grid, which means it's more reliable and resilient. So this is what we like to consider low-hanging fruit. It's the cheapest alternative to building a new hydro. From a 30,000-foot view, the project really is going to consist of installing a transformer in existing substation out at the Tidy Lake facility. That transformer is going to be 12 megawatts. And in the existing powerhouse, you can see the two generators there. That skeleton bay, the project would install a 12-megawatt generator in that skeleton bay. So going on to where we are today, from a permitting progress perspective, currently, actually in November of 2024, we were designated as the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's non-federal representative, and this is for the purposes of consultation with stakeholders such as SHPO, U.S. Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife, NOAA, and others. In December of 2024, we had our stakeholder consultation meetings and garnished 100% support for the project. It was recognized by stakeholders that there is real no environmental impact because we're not digging dirt, no new areas are being disturbed, and it's within an existing powerhouse. January 2025, with the written endorsements from our stakeholders, SEPA received a second waiver of second stage consultation, which means no rigorous long studies, which can be typical of a hydroelectric facility. And in February 2025, we filed our final application. Currently, it's in an expedited review at FERC. We anticipate approval from FERC in Q2, Q3, sometime this year. Any questions on the permitting progress?
Next slide.
Okay, next slide. Thank you. Design procurement progress. November 2024, SEPA has 100% procurement design specifications were completed. In 95, February of 2025, 90% construction specifications and drawings were complete. And anticipated in March, actually in about 9 days, our bids are due for the generator, transformer, and ancillary equipment. So right now we have an estimate, but we'll see what the market is actually doing here in about a week. In June of 2025, we anticipate final construction design, which means once we have the bids or the procurement contractor awarded, then we will know exactly what kind of generator they're going to produce, and that way we know how to hook all the remaining wires and pipes and things of that nature up. On construction schedule, as I mentioned, procurement in April, final fabrication, it's going to take about a year to get the final fabrication for the generator. So June of 26 is what we're looking at delivery of the generator and ancillary equipment. And then the transformers are actually longer. They're about 2 years out. So we're anticipating June of 27 with a final commissioning date in December of 2027. And then finally, we'll get to the financial outlook here. What you'll see here is a few different methods. This is the chart that SEPA submitted to the Department of Energy. On that, you'll see the Department of Energy Section 247 grant. That grant is a part of the Inflation Reduction Act, so it was on freeze, on a funding freeze. However, its sister grant, Section 243, was just unfrozen or thawed. And so we anticipate this grant as well will be thawed here in the coming weeks. That's a $5 million grant. As part of that application, we had to provide where we were going to come up with the remaining match. With the Alaska Energy Authority's recommendation to legislation last year for $4 million for the Southeast Alaska Grid Resiliency Project, we included that in part of the match for our financial outlook. Additionally, we have intention to file for investment tax credits through the IRS. This is something that we have hired a company to investigate, and they have high confidence that that program is grandfathered in, if you will, by law. And so they have high confidence that we will receive certain percentage of the project from that. The rest of the funding, which we've already expended, you can see $265,000 expended for the design of the switchgear, $858,000 for the design of the generator and turbine. And then we're at the point now in the 2025 season where once we sign a award the contract for procurement, they're going to want about 20 to 25% down as they build it, and then the remainder of that will be in 26.
Let's take a moment and make sure we know what all the abbreviations here mean.
Okay.
On the top, we've got switchgear, turbine, generator, transformer. For cash and ITC, what's ITC?
That's the investment tax credits.
Okay. Are there any other acronyms people would like explanation on? Shorthand. Co-Chair Holland, was there any more discussion about financials? Because I think this is the spot to get into it.
Thank you, Chair Mears. I think I had two questions I was percolating on here. One was in terms of the money here that is the SEPA cash and the ITC, is that coming out of operations and current rates where you are generating this cash to pay for this front-end work that's been done already, or is ITC giving you a separate source of cash separate from the operations from the rates?
Through the chair, we have received no funds from ITC from the investment tax credits. In fact, those are at the end of the projects.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all pretty, what you'll see here is SEPA reserves. And those are coming out of a forward funding reserve account that we have for capital investments. And so that fund is being depleted to perform the initial design and for both projects and the station service project as well.
Okay, thanks.
So it looks like the green is coming from ratepayers.
Correct.
And then yellow potentially from ratepayers in one way or another. If you're bonding, that's eventually coming from ratepayers. But if you get other grants, that's just supplemental. So
correct.
There's a good amount of this. The majority of this project is likely coming from ratepayers one way or the other.
The project total is about $20 million. And with the Renewable Energy Fund and the Department of Energy grant, that's approximately 50% or close to 50% of the project at $9 million. With the green cash is upfront cash or bonding that the agency would have to go out for, and yes, that would be ratepayer. It would most likely come from reserves and be replenished if the investment tax credits come through. So they would replenish the reserves.
Thank you, Representative Edgman.
So if the legislature did a bond package next year, would that meet the timeline of the $4.4 million?
We have a board meeting coming up here in 2 weeks. I have to make a recommendation to my board on whether or not we pause this project. With that being said, the uncertainty with the federal monies and the uncertainty with the Renewable Energy Fund, I would have to make that recommendation that we pause it. So we would delay the project most likely a year because we have we have an obligation once we sign the award of the contract for procurement to make payments, and those payments become due. Definitely, like I said, 20 to 30% in this year, but the remainder, because of the one-year fabrication timeline, would be due in January or February of next year, somewhere between now and in June, I would say.
Through the chair, there's the possibility then that your ratepayers, depending on what happens with the expected federal monies here, there could be a change. Your ratepayers may have to shoulder more of the burden potentially. Is that
that would be up to my board of directors? And yes, that's a potential if we go through with the project. The alternative is that the communities burn diesel, and as I mentioned, that's about 10 times the cost of hydroelectric.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I was just wondering, what's the number of ratepayers, and can you divide it in percentage between business and residential?
The Southeast Alaska Power Agency is a wholesale power producer, so we have three customers, mm-hmm. Ketchikan, Petersburg, and Wrangell. So to answer your question, I wouldn't do it justice. Population-wise, I can give you rough estimates. Ketchikan's somewhere on the order of 8,500 residents. Petersburg, 3,000 to 5,000. And Wrangell's 1,500 to 2,000. So maybe total of 15,000 total. But when you talk about ratepayers, you're talking about households. So you're looking at probably around 6,000, 6,500. But those, again, I'm not doing that very good justice.
Right. It just gives us a rough idea.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And are there large industrial users?
What was that?
Are there industrial sources or large commercial users that are in the customers on there?
There are a few. We have the Vigor Yard, but that may go away here soon in Ketchikan. My understanding is there's some funding that got cut by ADA. I'm not sure on that. Totally, but there is also the fisheries. So in Petersburg, Ketchikan, and Wrangell, there is some energy load in the summer for the fisheries. And as you saw in one of the previous slides, potentially dock electrification would be the cruise ships. And so that actually, one of the benefits of the cruise ships is that when they would want the energy is when the heating energy needs are the lowest. So it's kind of a balance between the summer loads and the winter loads. Kind of fits well into the energy portfolio.
Any other questions since we're on the financial side? All right. Well, thank you so much for your questions, committee. Please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you. I just want to finish off with the importance of the Renewable Energy Fund. I mentioned in here that that SEPA did utilize the recommendation from AEA as part of the funding potential process to get to the Department of Energy grant, the Section 247 grant. So federal match is a big benefit of the Renewable Energy Fund for leverage. Since inception, the Renewable Energy Fund has displaced over 100 million gallons of diesel in Alaska. You'll see on the right slide, the Department of Community and Regional Affairs shows the Alaska heating fuel prices in the summer of 2024 range from whatever, $1 to $18. I would probably say that's more like $3.50 to somewhere above $7 for sure. But with that, 100 million gallons is not just 100 million gallons of diesel. It's approaching $1 billion in savings to our communities that is now injected into Alaskan economy. So it's a big economic boost to Alaska that the Renewable Energy Fund really has made happen. Additionally, I've been watching a lot here in the legislation. I keep it on KTOO all the time, and when I hear something nice, I'd turn it up and listen. And I'm hearing a lot of times the operational budgets that we hear year after year are inflationary increases. And so we always want more money because inflation is eating everybody's lunch. And what I'm seeing is energy is fundamental to that. The energy costs in each one of the communities is fundamental. So if we don't do something about the energy costs, it's just going to go up next year. And we'll see the same increases year over year. We're not really fixing it, but the Renewable Energy Fund does. And that's by way of what we've shown in the last bullet point there of 100 million gallons is really an economic benefit to Alaska. Again, and also the Renewable Energy Fund is a program for all Alaskans, all the way from Nome to Ketchikan. I think we'll see Nome on the list and Ketchikan on the list. So it's a very wide-ranged program. And finally, the fully funded cost, if you take the $21 million that's currently on the list and you divide it by a balanced budget, which these numbers may not be correct, but in terms of revenues and balanced budgets, $6.5 billion, rough order estimate, the cost of fully funding the REF is 0.3%. That's all I have.
Thank you. Got a few more minutes for questions or clarifications or points to be made. Co-Chair Holland?
First off, I'd just like to back up half a step and just acknowledge that the question I asked earlier about how the savings might be used to help to finance some of the projects, you ended up kind of addressing the fact that you already are using ratepayer funds to do a lot of the projects. So I just want to acknowledge that you really are putting a tremendous amount into the projects, and the local community is already investing substantially in this project, and I recognize that with the additional detail you provided there, so thank you. I wanted to jump, though, forward in a bit of a leading softball question, but given the amount of renewable energy that you have and the amount of renewable energy that you might even be able to develop, are you looking at other opportunities kind of moving ahead to how the energy could be produced as an economic engine for your area in terms of exporting that energy in some form to be able to actually generate revenue from the renewable energy you have? And, of course, I'm thinking of the Cordova example that we talked about before that's starting to use some renewable energy for some data processing. And I'm just wondering, are there some other opportunities that if we had an investment mindset of creating future economic growth for the area beyond just simply solving the diesel problem, I'm wondering how do we think beyond solving the diesel problem to actually creating new economic opportunity? Are there any near-term practical projects or opportunities that you know of that we should be aware of that might help us think beyond just avoiding some diesel costs but actually thinking towards some greater resilience for the community and economic opportunity?
Yes, through the chair. That's a great question, and the answer is absolutely yes. The Pacific Ocean is the largest solar panel in the world, and it dumps its energy in southeast Alaska. So we have significant amount of projects that we could build. Right now, hydroelectric projects have been built solely either on ratepayers paying debt service or potential or partly funded by the state. However, that is starting to change. As artificial intelligence server farms come in, the technologies of potentially developing and producing hydrogen, building new hydro, doesn't necessarily have to be only for residential homes and industrial services. It could also meet the needs of other types of technologies that are out there today. And with that, you know, some of these hydroelectric projects, if you were to build them, even if it was given to us, we would still have to pay for the operations and maintenance costs. And so these technologies, these sectors, would be great anchor tenants, if you will, paying debt service, paying the O&M costs, and with a certain percentage of these projects still being available to the residential consumers, which would lower the costs.
So you'd mentioned rising energy costs being a factor that drives people away from small communities, particularly where you're serving. I'd imagine the corollary would be applicable as well with lowering energy costs. That makes it more attractive for living throughout Alaska or anywhere if those energy costs are lower, both for residents and then for commercial opportunity.
Yes, absolutely. The lower the energy costs, the more technology and companies look to invest in the area. If you take the Bonneville Power Administration and the Columbia River, for example, Boardman, Oregon has significantly grown as a function of Amazon server farms and other things because the cost of energy is so low. Looking at Alaska, not too many people want to invest in any kind of energy-intensive projects because the cost of energy in Alaska is so high. However, if we were to make partnerships and say, you know, a certain dedicated portion of a project would go towards, you know, paying the debt service or whatever, and the other portion would go to lowering the rates for all Alaskans, that would definitely be a good thing.
Thank you so much. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Edgman?
Yeah, just a couple of quick observations. So population overall in Southeast is declining. I don't think it's precipitously, but it's on a downward curve. Hopefully, more inexpensive, affordable energy will help sort of arrest that curve. But I couldn't help noticing on another point, the fuel literage costs on a per unit basis must be impacted if there's less fuel year in, year out, or potentially. I don't think you probably have that data or anything like that on hand. Not that it's even material to this discussion, but that's just something that I noticed. Less fuel every year in theory, declining population. It would be interesting just to see how all that's impacted the per unit cost, and then if that trickles up north to where my district is in Southwest in terms of Crowley's activities and what have you. It may not. I bring it up just as a point of observation. Lastly, since I'm quite on a roll here, the bigger topic of Wantana up north has to sit there and speaking of lost energy and lost potential and more inexpensive opportunities up ahead as somewhat of an example of what could be if we could do what Southeast has done, because the fact that, 70% of your residents are using this cheaper power for electric heating, that's incredible. Yeah. I mean, the potential when you start wrapping your brain around it is pretty phenomenal on a larger scale up north. So, Madam Co-Chair, none of that made sense, I'm sure, but I just sort of blurted it all out at once.
It made a lot of sense, and we're definitely we've been having some discussions about the fragility of our fuel delivery systems, particularly in your region, but that applies across the state. And what is changing demand is going to do to the fragility? Does it make it a little stronger because there's less demand, so things can be more robust, or is that reduction in demand going to draw some competition out and either leave a monopoly or just not make it worthwhile financially to do that? Also, the discussion of electrifying heat, I think it's 50% going from of folks in Southeast that are using electrified heat. And we'd had a little conversation in the office earlier about the technology on heat pumps advancing, so it's getting easier to install, and then there's more opportunities. Like right now, most of the heat pump technology is air-to-air, but going from air to water, so homes like mine in Anchorage that have got baseboard heaters that are, you know, hydronic would have the opportunity to start getting into that. Can we take just a couple of minutes if you can touch on that, and then we'll get on to our next presenters?
Yeah, absolutely. We like to call it disruptive technologies. It's kind of like when we went from the horse to the car. In the heat pump industry, we've been seeing breakthroughs in that technology where colder climates now are able to use the cost savings of newer technologies in that form of heat pumps, and you can see coefficients of performance increasing as at lower temperatures. Right now, 10 years ago, a heat pump would have significantly low coefficient of performance, so it would be like running it as an electric baseboard. But now they're getting up to 2, 3, even 4 COPs, coefficient of performance, in colder climates, and it really has to do with the refrigerant, because when you compress something, if it doesn't freeze, it's free to move, and then you can take, if it's colder than the temperature is outside, then it can take the heat from outside and bring it back inside. So the better the refrigerant, well, in some cases you'd have to do that at higher pressures. So the technologies, the pressure and the refrigerant type. So yes, we're absolutely seeing that, and that's the air-to-air. Also seeing that in another technology, and that is the air-to-water. Daikin has a thermal unit that can heat water up to 80 degrees C. That's our typical boiler temperature for homes. So potentially we could be seeing in the very near future a full swap out of your existing boiler with a heat pump boiler without any change to your registers throughout your home. So no new air ducting, that type of thing. So I'd keep a lookout on that technology as they progress. And I look forward to the future in that area.
I appreciate Southeast being early adopters on that to make that a little easier for the rest of the state to get on board as we work some wrinkles out there. Thank you very much, Mr. Seamy. We really appreciate your coming to visit us in person today, sharing your perspective on your project and some larger issues as well. We really appreciate that. Next, the committee will hear from John Balke, Village Administrator from Pedro Bay Village Council, who will be joining us remotely. Just to note, we will be forwarding through your slide deck in the committee room, so please share with us when we need to advance your slides. With that, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
All right. Thank you very much. For the record, I'm John Balke, administrator for the Pedro Bay Village Council. I'm not an engineer, and so I may not be able to answer all of the technical sorts of questions. I was hoping to have our consulting engineer from Polar Consult with us today, but he's unable to do so. So I will move through these slides and hopefully give you a good sense of the project. So it's the Knutson Creek Hydro Project. It's a small hydro. The village itself is quite small. If you look at the second slide, a little overview. I'll go through Pedro Bay Village, local energy needs, give a little project overview, and then the current project status. Pedro Bay is a traditional Dena'ina Athabascan village, strong subsistence traditions. Current population is about 34, so to give you a sense of how big of a community it is. We do have a larger summer population, probably upwards of 60 people. There's one larger lodge that is in the community and operates in the summer. We do have a few commercial accounts. The state State of Alaska, the Department of Transportation, and then, of course, communications companies that are serving the village. Next slide. Pedro Bay Village priorities, certainly to preserve the heritage and traditional values, strong community. To protect local subsistence resources, Pedro Bay is located on the east end of Lake Iliamna, which is certainly part of the Bristol Bay fishery. Red salmon come up into the lake and all the way up to the east end and spawn in the creeks and shorelines around Pedro Bay. And it's also subsistence salmon is probably the thing that really holds the local culture together. The community also wants to just build in sustainability, improve local economic and energy security, and most of all right now, encourage families to live in and return to Pedro Bay. I've seen the population decrease over the past so many years. In the last few, I believe we're seeing a little bit of an uptick again. People are interested in living in the village. They're able to work remotely. And the village council this last year has purchased the former school that's in the community from the borough. And we're hoping to turn that into a community center and make it available for the local residents. The school unfortunately closed about 11 years ago in the community, so we're working on it. And energy costs has a part to play in that. The next slide, the local energy profile. Currently, we rely on existing diesel fire generation. We go through roughly 24,000 gallons of diesel a year for electric generation. And on top of that, there's quite a bit more just for heating in the community. We have a state-maintained gravel airstrip, 3,000 feet, so it limits the size of aircraft that can come in to the village. And so bringing fuel in, all of our fuel really right now is brought in by air. And so there are options to bring it in over the water from Bristol Bay up the Kwajalein River down Iliamna Lake or via across Cook Inlet over the Williamsport Hall Road and then back onto a barge and across Lake Iliamna. And so this is very expensive and there are limited carriers that would even do this. And so for the most part, we just fly fuel in from usually from the Kenai area. It can be very expensive and then also very weather dependent. And if we don't get enough fuel in at the right time, we have issues with both weather and then the condition of the runway to bring in planes carrying fuel. So we have the vulnerabilities, fuel supply insecurity, can we get the fuel delivered, the high price and price volatility for fuel. If they can't bring in larger aircraft, it has to come in on smaller aircraft, like we've had to do some this year, the bringing it in a caravan. And so we're bringing in very limited volumes, the price goes up. So we're having to deal with those kinds of things. And then just the risk of spills, which is always a concern the more times you have to handle the fuel and transfer it from aircraft into trucks, truck it into the village, put it in the tanks and so forth. The greater chance, of course, of spills and, you know, given the sensitivity of the environment and the fisheries and things like that, that's something we are definitely concerned about. Next slide. Just a quick look at sort of a local energy profile. Our going rate for electricity without power cost equalization is roughly 91 cents per kilowatt hour. With the PCE, brings it down into a somewhat reasonable range for customers. But of course, it, you know, PCE has its limits as well in terms of how much a resident can use or a commercial, and the commercial operators don't have that PCE. And fuel cost, of course, it varies, but probably averages about $6.50 per gallon, which is pretty good for on Lake Ileana. We typically do have some of the better rates for fuel on the lake, but it's still quite high. And there's a little bit of a chart there just kind of showing over some years the annual kilowatts generated and then the average annual fuel price, and then the rate has gone up certainly. I think probably it's been about the same now for the last 10 years, running in that 80 to 90 cents per kilowatt hour. next slide. So some of the local energy solutions we've looked at, certainly solar and wind are, you know, easier to deploy, but they do have limited diesel displacement and different things that can affect them. The life cycle is not quite as long. And so the village settled on hydro, and we do have several creeks. And we did some feasibility work a while back, and so it seemed like a good option for the village. It's kind of a proven rural Alaska technology, as noted by the previous presenter. Has a higher diesel displacement, and you know, the drawbacks are a longer development timeline, and sort of certainly the higher capital cost. But it does provide certainly a longer life. There are numerous 50 to 100-year-old hydro equipment still running in rural Alaska. We do have another hydro down the lake at Tazimina, which has been operating for quite a number of years and does quite well. Next slide. A Knutsen Hydro overview. It's certainly a local, clean, and sustainable energy solution. It would displace a lot of the diesel that would need to be brought in. The project itself would be a run-of-the-river hydro operation, so no storage. It would divert up to 11.5 cubic feet per second, and then into a 6,400-foot long, 24-inch diameter pipeline or penstock. There's 205 feet of elevation drop to create about 179 feet of head pressure. There would be 125 kilowatt powerhouse, and then the water would be sent back into the river. The project would include about 9,700 feet of underground power and communications cable, and involve about 12,500 feet of total roads and trails. It would meet 96% of annual utility demand. And it would also support electric heat and load growth. And sort of, again, the electrified heat option would be really an excellent opportunity for the village to displace a lot of diesel in terms of heating as well. So that's an added bonus of the project. next slide. Knutsen Hydro Performance. Again, hydro will serve 96% of the utility demand. There would be a few times of year, certainly in the spring, low flows, and then also including releases for fish habitat. There would be some flow maintenance involved, and then hydro maintenance outages, and then monthly diesel use to keep the diesel plant healthy. So we would continue to maintain the diesel as a backup and also for use during those few times of the year when we would have to wouldn't have the flow necessary to provide what we needed. The chart on the slide gives kind of a daily energy demand and supply, except the average daily utility demand. Utility demand met by diesel is just would kind of show you the limited times. The excess hydro output would be available for heat and load growth. And so it's kind of a 20-year model run. And again, I'm not the technical one here to describe this probably to the degree it could be, but hopefully it gives you a little bit of a sense of the performance of the project. Next slide gives you a little bit of a look at the layout. You can see by the little map on the right hand, up the upper part of the creek would involve a diversion and intake structure, then the penstock and access trail. Penstock would also cross over the creek partway down, and then go on down to the powerhouse and tail race. There would be an access road from the existing road near our airport, and the whole project would be tied in, of course, to our existing transmission system and the existing diesel power plant in the village. The timeline so far, we did a reconnaissance study that was back in 2008 and 2009. We did a feasibility study in 2010 through 2013. We've done design and permitting 2014 to 2022. We still have a few little design and permitting things we have to finish up, but we are basically now in the funding and final design permitting tasks phase, and we're hoping, if all goes well, to begin construction in 2026. I guess that is next year, and 2027. So it would be a two-phase project. What we've requested from the REF fund is basically the non-federal share involved in the project. It's kind of a smallish request of about $400,000, and that would be cover 2 years, two phases, basically. Phase one would be about $4.3 million, and phase two would be about $5.6 million overall. And the federal share would be $218,000 and $182,000, which would be the $400,000 from the REF fund. Next slide, just looking at challenges behind and ahead. The slow permitting, and most of that is behind us now. We've done over 7 years of fishery studies to determine just how many sockeye are using the Knutsen Creek drainage and within the reach of the project. There's just in the numbers of tens of Sakai using the project area. So that's really good. We haven't had to do too many sort of mitigating things there. We've done 7 years worth of hydrology study. We affirmed that it's FERC non-jurisdictional, so we don't have to worry about that so much, but it did take us over a year just to affirm that. And then we have the ongoing sort of monitoring requirements and the O&M costs borne by ratepayers. Capital funding total right now, looking at it, is about $7.982 million. That price, of course, has gone up since we started looking at the project. And as I mentioned, the AEA Round 16 REF application was for a match for federal funding. We have gone out to federal Department of Energy. We've also made a FY26 congressionally directed spending request. And so we're looking at whatever federal avenues we have in terms of grants. So the project would be hopefully entirely grant funded if possible. And then, of course, there's sort of the after effects, the production and investment tax credits. And so that kind of depends on what exists when we build. And next slide, the path ahead. Upcoming milestones is obviously to secure capital funding to construct and then operation. And results, hopefully better economy through local jobs, lower stabilized electric rates, a boost to the village's sustainability and security, protects and enhances local resources, and completed project will be hopefully self-sustaining. But it'd be a huge boost for the community. We are trying to, model what we can for a small community in rural Alaska in various ways, and hopefully something that could be reproduced or looked at in other communities as well. And the takeaway is it all worth it? And I guess every community with an old hydro says yes, so we're going with that. And thank you, and do let me know, I guess, if there are any questions I can ask or I can get the answers for you, hopefully. We do appreciate everything, the REF Fund has done already for the community and getting these studies done and going through this process, and certainly would happy to be on the list. Hopefully, maybe the funding will be forthcoming this next year here. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a question from... you might need to mute us while we're talking. All good? Okay. Thank you. Got a question from Coacher Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair. And I've got a couple questions. The first one, I think I just picked up from your final closing comments that a lot of the development work perhaps has been funded through the REF funds that you may have received already. Is that correct?
Through the chair. Yes, that is correct. Reconnaissance study, feasibility study, design and permitting, I believe, have all come through the REF. And based, I think, on the limitations or in terms of the size of our project, we've limited our request as well for capital help. So
Follow up.
Great. Thank you. To the chair again. And remind me how many gallons per year, roughly, of diesel you've been having to bring in to provide the generation that you've done over this past history that we're looking at. Do you have a rough average per year of diesel gallons?
Yes. Again, thank you. Through the chair, I believe it's in the range of 24,000 a year, so about averaging 2,000 gallons a month.
so that's, it looks like $100,000 a year in diesel costs that you've had over 17 years. So about $2 million. Okay, thank you. What I'm trying to make sense of here is that this project has been going on for 17 years now. And for 17 years, you're having to fly diesel in to keep alive a high-cost power generation system. And for 17 years, it looks like we know how to solve the challenge of electrification of this village to essentially provide all of the energy you need from a hydro project. And I'm just trying to connect the dots on how we can think differently about being able to accelerate more of these projects to get the benefit to these communities that in the meantime are flying fuel in with a caravan, which to me just is surprising to think about moving 25,000 gallons of fuel a year in a caravan. I cannot imagine the amount of cost that takes in handling the risks of all those flights. It's just phenomenal. So I guess I'm sorry, I'm kind of rambling for a second. I'm wondering, from your perspective of working with the REF, working on this project diligently over the years, do you have any recommendations for us on how you think this program could help this project and how we might accelerate these sorts of projects along? I mean, I suspect the simple answer is just put more in the REF, but maybe you've got some deeper insight into how we could manage this so that the benefits could be helping us justify doing more of these projects sooner. Sorry for a long rambling run up to the question, if it's even there.
Thank you. Through the chair, I don't know what exactly to suggest. Certainly the funding is, you know, one of the items. And I know there, I think just, you know, if we could reuse some of the things we've learned, I feel like there are really limited consultants maybe who work and engineers who work in this area, but maybe there's some way to consolidate or even bring to bear through the state or AEA, Energy Authority, to provide perhaps, especially for some of the smaller communities, and I know, you know, agencies like or cooperatives like AVAC and others, you know, certainly I think are great in order to help a lot of the smaller villages that just don't have the capacity, you know, to even kind of know where to start with some of this. We've been very fortunate to have some good help, I think, along the way, just to get to where we are, really.
Just brief follow-up.
Brief follow-up, then yeah. Representative Edgman.
Oh, great. Thanks. So, anyway, thank you for indulging my question. I just want to acknowledge 17 years' worth of work to shepherd this project along. I'm really impressed, but I'm also trying to figure out how we can do more to support that, because that is a long time to be working on a project like this with the kind of benefits. So thank you for the work you're doing.
Thank you. Representative Edgman was in the queue before you, Representative Kopp. Representative Edgman.
Yes, I just wanted to say thank you, John. Great presentation. A couple things sort of, you know, sort of leap out at me. Number one is how the project at Peter Bay is really a poster child for why the Renewable Energy Grant Fund program is very important to smaller communities, you know, a program that's been around since 2008. I'm right about, let's see, doing some quick math, is that 12? That's about when this program started, right-ish. And also a salute to your being in the community for the many years that you've been there and really a prime example. If you have good leadership at the local level, Peter Bay, a community of 34 people, you can have the ability to pursue something like this, which is pretty much a complicated project. Not every small community has good leadership or has a sort of a dedicated tribal administrator like John. But for any you know, sort of hesitancy out there about fully funding the REF program, this story tells you why it's really important.
Thank you, Representative Kopp.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, so the question I have is just related to the dependency on fuel being flown in. And I had for the presenter, I wanted to say Mr. Knutson. I realized that was the name of the hydro project. Balky, thank you. Mr. Knutson, this is Representative Chuck Kopp. Is your main supply of fuel now all air fuel or is some barged? I missed that.
Yes, through the chair. Yes, it's entirely flown in. Years ago, fuel was brought in by barge, but most of those services are no longer really working on the lake, Iliamna area. And so we do fly it all in. And like I said, this year we've had to resort to some smaller aircraft just due to conditions. But, you know, normally if they can get a bigger plane in, like a C-46, you know, they can bring in 2,000 gallons at a time, which is much better than what can be done with a caravan. And unfortunately, you know, we lost one of our prime carriers this last year with the crash up in Fairbanks and Alaska Air Fuel, I think it was, and they were able to bring in, you know, larger quantities. But, you know, there's a lot of risks, obviously, involved.
Yes. So just follow up. So, yeah, Alaska Air Fuel was, and it was one of the main suppliers to the entire region out there. And it highlights the vulnerability of the whole supply chain. Mr. Balky, so who is, a couple questions, your fuel supplier now, and did the crash of Alaska Air Fuel drive up the cost for you?
Through the chair, yes, I would say the costs have gone up. We utilize primarily Everett's Air Fuel, but we did also use Alaska Air Fuel and so we have incurred, you know, some higher prices just due to when you have smaller volumes, you know, that can be brought in, the price is going to be higher. So,
yeah. Madam Co-Chair, this is one of those things where after that tragic crash, it was well known in rural Alaska that was the only competition was between those two carriers. And when that went away, prices would go up even more. And I don't know if there's something, you know, we can do through PCE or through other things, but Representative Edgen might have something to say about this. But to help these air carriers keep the prices down. Another great idea here from a colleague would be maybe looking at some investments in Williams Bay Portage, Williamsport, to help get fuel over to Pedro Bay, coming down from Cook Inlet and across the mountain pass there. What do you think about that, Mr. Balky? Representative Edgman's helping me out here with some ideas.
Through the chair. Yeah, certainly. And I know there have been, there's at least one other service that has brought fuel across the Williamsport Pile Bay Road via Cook Inlet. And but I know there were also some issues, you know, with, again, transferring fuel at Williamsport from either bringing trucks across or tanks across, having to transfer it from tanks there into a truck, then taking that truck across the haul road, then having to transfer it or put the truck on a barge and haul it down the lake. And so there are a lot of concerns, certainly, in terms of, you know, the environmental potential problems. And there was a spill a few years back. A truck was parked near the Iliamna River, and I think, you know, fuel leaked. And so it's certainly a possibility, but I think, again, they're just the, you know, the environmental and the concerns of having to transfer the fuel between different vessels and the potential problems that it creates. But if we could, you know, make it more environmentally safe and find a better way to do it, I think that would certainly be a good possibility for the, you know, the villages on the lake. So.
And we're not looking at completely eliminating fuel deliveries, right, because you're still going to have the spinning reserve for the diesel, and I imagine gasoline is something you also import. So it would just vastly reduce it, but the infrastructure for bringing in fuel is still necessary. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Kopp?
Just a comment that, like Representative Holland said, these permitting timelines are just unbelievable, how much perseverance it's taking to bring clean energy into a region that clearly has so much support. And I feel like whatever we can do to help, you know, this, that's the economic life of these communities, is this type of energy. And, you know, so that's it. I'll have to say.
Reduce the dependence on importing things around. I like that. Any further follow-ups for Mr. Balky before we cut him loose and get on to Mr. Stamm? Thank you so much for your presentation and conversation today. Really appreciate the work that you're doing and sharing that with us. Next, we will see where I am here. Wrapping up our hearing today, we're joined remotely by Bill Stamm, President and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. You may recall he was here in person with us a few weeks ago with the utilities and sat on the panel and participated our utility week. As the last presenter, Mr. Stamm will be forwarding through your slide deck in the committee room. So please let us know when you want us to advance your slides. And of course, now please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Bill Stamm, President and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for asking me to testify on behalf of ABEC for our application to the Renewable Energy Fund.
Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, my pleasure. And also for supporting the technology that allows me to do this from my office in Anchorage rather than having to travel to Juneau. So thank you for that. And I guess also hats off to my two predecessors. Presentation from Mr. Seidman certainly accentuated the impact and benefit of the Renewable Energy Fund. And for Mr. Balky, vulnerability in the cost of fuel supply to rural Alaska can't be overstated. Our situation is a little bit different in some of our communities, but I am here to speak about the CHEBAC battery energy storage system, one of the applications that we had for the Renewable Energy Fund. And if you would advance the slide to the next run for me. This list is probably one that you are all familiar with. It's the list from AEA that was forwarded from the Round 16 Renewable Energy Fund. Those projects above the dark black line were funded previously. In the far right-hand column is a blue section where I've been tracking. That indicates the funding that was suggested in the governor's budget proposal and covers another six projects or so. The two highlighted in yellow are both ABEC projects that were submitted to the Renewable Energy Fund. One of them may be funded if the funding is as far as allowed or provided by the governor. And the other one that I'm speaking of today is in CHEBAC, a little bit further down the line. But both the CHEBAC and Quinnahog projects are very similar. They intend to install a battery energy storage system on an existing wind diesel microgrid. Next slide, please. Just a recap, and I know not all committee members were able to attend when I was invited a little over a month ago and presented with other compatriots from cooperatives on the rail belt about energy issues in general. So just a brief recap, Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, member-owned cooperative, and we serve power to 58 rural communities around Alaska, everywhere from the southeast up to the northwest Arctic. We have over 46 power plants. We have over 160 diesel generators, and that is our primary mode of power generation. We typically have two or three generators, or three or four generators in every community to meet various loads and have redundancy in the communities. We burn over 9.5 million gallons of diesel fuel a year. It is probably the highest cost of any component for us supplying energy, and as has been expressed previously, the supply chains for fuel in rural Alaska, even if they're coming by barge, are vulnerable to weather and seasons and economic competition, which seems to be dwindling. Since 2000, we've been installing renewable energy systems on our microgrids. We now have 13 wind sites with 33 turbines, contributing some amount of the power to 22 villages. And last year, our annual revenue was close to $78 million. I highlighted those two numbers in blue on the screen, the $42.3 million for diesel fuel and the $77.9 million annual revenue. You can see that more than half the cost of energy goes just to buying fuel to put in the tanks to generate power. And the way AVEX rates work, we have a non-fuel cost, which is pretty much a postage stamp rate for all of our communities, except for Bethel, which is much larger than most of our other communities. So there's a non-fuel cost, which is the same for all payers. And then there's a fuel component on top of that that is different for every community, and it's based specifically on what it costs to get diesel to that community and how efficient their system is, how much diesel we have to burn per kilowatt hour. Total electricity sold in 2024 was about 126 megawatt hours. If you want to do some quick math on that, $78 million divided by 126 megawatt hours works out to be about 62 cents per kilowatt hour for an average cost of electricity. And that is an average cost. Mr. Bulkey had mentioned his costs were about 91 cents kilowatt hour. In the communities that were flying in fuel, most recently we had costs above $1 per kilowatt hour. We were paying upwards to $12 a gallon to fly fuel into NOATAC over the last couple of years. So it can be very expensive. And regardless of the transport, there's always a question of whether you're going to be able to fill your tanks every year. Next slide, please. This just emphasizes again where the money goes. What we need to do in order to provide power is logistically challenging. Only one of our communities is accessible by road. Everything else has to be flown or barged in. And that big blue chunk of the pie is all fuel. The next largest cost in that pie section is operation and maintenance of generation. So that includes all of our overhauls and replacements and maintenance of our diesel power plants and facilities. And you can just kind of run through the rest of those. Those are 2023 numbers. I don't have audited financials yet for the rest of those numbers. I think our overall balance for 2024 fuel costs came down a little bit last year, so it was only about 54% of our overall operating cost, but consistently is more than 50% of our cost of operation. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, because fuel is such an important component, we've been doing renewable projects since about 2000, primarily wind projects, and we've always felt that there's more that can be done to squeeze the benefit out of the projects that are already there, and that's kind of the basis for battery energy storage projects and what we've started to do most recently. But we have both wind and solar. Those items that are there in gold medallions are the solar projects that we've done. The larger solar projects that we've done have been with independent power producers in the Northwest Arctic Borough, and those do presently include battery energy storage. AVEX has three energy storage projects that have just been recently deployed and not fully commissioned, one in Stebbins, one in Shaktulik, and one in St. Mary's. We can go to the next slide, please. So we always use the term BESS for battery energy storage system. And just to let you know what that includes, this is a little bit smaller system than what would be included in GVAC. This one is a 274 kilowatt hour battery energy storage system. Usually they're described with those two units, the kilowatts, indicating how much power a unit could push out, and the kilowatt hours is how much energy is actually stored. So this could meet a load of 200 kW for more than an hour. You know, if it was just a single hour, it would be 200 kW, 200 kilowatt hour. But that's kind of what those units describe. Inside that BESS module, there are the batteries themselves, the energy storage, the chemical components. Lithium ion phosphate batteries are what we typically use. They have a higher safety rating than other lithium technologies, less likely to catch fire and stay burning. There's a battery monitoring system that helps balance the loads between the cells. Really is the health and maintenance of those systems, controls the charge and discharge rates into the batteries. So it's kind of the brains of maintenance for those energy cells. There's an inverter which converts the power from AC to DC. So most of the power that we distribute in our system is alternating current. We can charge the batteries with alternating current by pushing power into the inverter and charging the battery. When the battery has power that we can use, it pushes it through the inverter, converts it back to AC, and puts it out on our system. And there's always controls and communications. And because these things sit out in the weather, there's heating, ventilation, air conditioning requirements. We have to keep the buildings warm when they're not in use. And often we have to provide external cooling or mechanical cooling in order to keep them operating so they don't overheat in the summertime. Things do warm up when the system is in operation, charging and discharging. The inverters get warm, the battery cells get warm, and on a warm summer day, certainly could overheat. I just threw some numbers down on the Shaktulik project that we had. Funding came from the Valley Commission, Office of Energy, and AVEC ratepayers themselves. I guess bulk of the project, so you're looking at a lot of what would be installed in either of these other communities that have been recommended. There's the module itself, again, for GVAC. That would probably be two modules, or at least a larger module than you see there. The foundation, access to it. There's connections to the power plant. You see some piping in the background, those straight lines. That is actually heat piping that comes off of our cooling system to keep the building warm in the wintertime. There's power cables that come back to the power plant, and that's connected into our 480-volt plant bus. Connects to our switchgear. The controls you don't really see so much of. It's Ethernet cabling between buildings for communications and programmable logic controllers in order to control the system. We would also do some upgrades to the controls within the power plant, upgrading some of our diesel controllers and the master controller in the power plant in order to operate with the new equipment. Next slide, please. Just checking that we're on the same page. This should be a picture of four wind turbines and say GVAC BESS on it. Are we tracking?
Yep.
Okay. So this just gives the general sizes of what we're looking at for GVAC. Again, a little bit larger system. GVAC is a little bit larger community. It's between 900 and 1,000 population, I believe, out there. But peak load of about 600 kW. We have four existing wind turbines out there. And the BESS system partners with the wind system in order to make the diesel system more efficient. Unfortunately, we're not able to get rid of the diesel system entirely. There will be times when we have energy storage and a competent energy inverter that we could run entirely on wind for certain hours of the day or certain days of the week. But there will always be a need for diesel in these communities. Presently in GVAC, I think we're displacing about 20 to 25% of the diesel fuel. With this wind storage, we expect to double that to be 40 to 50% of the diesel fuel use in the community. what the energy storage system allows us to do is run the most efficient diesel unit presently, with the variability of both the load in the community and the reduction in load from the variable wind source. We often have to run a much larger diesel generator than is needed to actually meet the load. That diesel generator creates the grid. It provides the voltage and frequency that's needed in order to power the system. But there's only so much of a limit that we can lower the load on that diesel unit. So at times we start spilling wind or turning off turbines. The turbines that we have at the 100 kW rate are not as sophisticated as some of the much larger turbines that you would see with pitch control and veining on the wind turbine blades. So they basically run at whatever speed the wind pushes them at. They have a certain power curve that they operate on. And if you don't like the power that they're generating at that wind speed, your option is to leave it on or to turn it off. So we can have some fairly large transients when we are trying to regulate the power and match the power on the grid by having to turn these 100 kW blocks on and off. Part of what the battery energy storage system allows us to do is absorb power when we might be producing too much and inject power when we might need just a little bit more in order to prevent either starting a larger diesel generator or having to run a larger one just to catch the amount of power that might be lost. So as you can imagine, we call it spinning reserve. As you can imagine, if you're chugging along and you've got 400 kW of wind and you've got 600 kW load in the community, 200 is on the diesel unit, you would think, well, I can run a 200 kW diesel and take care of that. But in actuality, we have two different size units. We have two at 500 kW and one at about 750 kW. Because the load, the actual background load, is 600 kW, we would most likely be running the largest generator we have, just in case the wind dies down and we have a fault and we have to continue to provide power. We wouldn't have any reaction time to start that larger unit without energy storage. So that's one of the things that the BESS system does, creates that spinning reserve or synthetic spinning reserve, so that if there is a major dropout in the other generation source, the wind source, we have time to start up a diesel generator and get back online without turning the lights off. Next slide, please. So we've done some modeling. There's a fairly extensively used renewable microgrid modeling system called Homer modeling. We've run that a few different ways with different size storage based on the loads that we've seen and the wind profile that we've seen in GVAC. And we expect to just about double the amount of wind production that we can capture in GVAC by having some sort of energy storage. And as I mentioned, it allows us to run a smaller diesel for more hours of the day. That's a benefit not only in fuel consumption, but also the wear and tear on a larger engine. If every hour of operation is an hour closer to overhaul, and it's much more expensive to overhaul larger engines than it is a smaller engine. So the more we can run our small units, we're saving power, we're saving cost of diesel fuel, and we're also saving overall maintenance costs. The inverter technology that's available today, it allows it to form the grid. So what that means is we don't necessarily have to run a diesel in order to produce 60 hertz power that is controlled typically by a diesel genset. That can be handled now through a battery with inverter technology. So we're estimating that we might go up to 170 hours a year diesel off, which we have done in other communities. And it's a pretty exciting and amazing thing to hear the diesel generation system in a small community get turned off and still have the lights on. It brings a smile to every operator's face when it happens the first time. And aside from the fuel savings, maintenance savings, all those sorts of things, The battery does provide higher power quality and reliability. As I mentioned, even if we had diesels online and we were anticipating that they would stay online, but they did not, the battery could cover the power needs depending on what the load is for a certain duration of time and give us a little bit more time to react, either start another unit or respond, have the local plant operator respond and keep the lights on. Next slide, please. So where are we at with the project status? As I mentioned, we've done quite a bit of modeling. Our price estimates and general layout of what we intend to do have been worked through with contractors and consultants that we've worked with on other similar projects. As I mentioned, we've recently built out three other projects in a similar fashion in other communities, so we're fairly confident in the technology and what is needed in order to see a successful project. The permitting should be somewhat limited. Should be able to get a categorical exclusion from NEPA. All of the improvements will be built on the CHIVAC power plant site. Don't expect to be having much soil disruption or anything like that. There will be a fire marshal permit required, but again, we've accomplished that in other communities and don't see a limitation there. Financing, the estimate that we provided for the Renewable Energy Fund summer of 2023, we've escalated that anticipated cost, probably a minimum of 25% increase since then. It's a little bit of a unknown. I think everybody's waiting to see the impacts of some of the tariff implications and those sorts of things, both on materials and fuels. Certainly for fuel costs, that's not only just what fuel costs for us to burn, but also the transport of every material that we put out in rural communities. Fuel component weighs heavily on transportation and freight as well. So even with the REF funding, we would be seeking additional funds. AVEC does have budget to do capital projects, but that is fairly limited, and we are fairly widespread. We do have other projects in the pipeline. Most notably, I think there are about 20 communities that, not AVEC in particular, but we have partnered with the Northwest Story Borough, ANTHC, and Tanana Chiefs Conference for renewable projects in many of our communities, and those are all infrastructure funds that have been placed on hold and still a little bit in limbo as to how they move forward. And depending on how many of those projects are ongoing at the same time, it impacts severely what AVEC's cash flow is and what we'll be able to put towards this project over the next 18 months, depending on when funding comes through. So we would be seeking additional support from most likely Department of Energy Division or Department of Indian Energy. The Rural Utility Service and USDA and Denali Commission are some likely possibilities. Timeline, if we did have funding lined up by the end of this summer, we would go through design and procurement into the fall and early winter, order some of our longer lead time items, and that would be the BESS module itself. We already have specifications that we've used in the past, so it would be updating those for specific project and getting it out on the street. I feel confident that if we had those designs out on the street in December or January, we would be able to take delivery before the last March sales to CHIVAC in that same year. We would be doing installation into the late fall and a limited commissioning over the winter. We'd probably get it tied in and tested and operating primarily in support, but we wouldn't be doing the full testing and diesels off and those sorts of things until the weather improved and we were a little more confident that we weren't going to trip the plant offline unnecessarily. And that's my presentation for the Renewable Energy Fund. And I guess I'd just like to echo the fact that some of the infrastructure that's already in place in GVAC, the wind project that's in place was also partially funded by the Renewable Energy Fund back in the earlier years. So, yes, it has made an impact in a lot of communities, and it continues to provide improvement for the economy and living expenses for folks out in rural Alaska.
Thank you so much, Mr. Sham. I really appreciate you joining us again. And just to remind members of the committee, as we're queuing up any final questions, we also have Connor Erickson from Alaska Energy Authority on the line if there are any questions, broader questions for him about the REF program. I'm not seeing some nods here. Co-Chair Hallam, you got something?
Oh, always. This is such interesting projects. I've got just two areas I wanted to touch on briefly. I know it's getting late, and we've been through a lot of material. First off, I think looking at the second to last slide here, I'm curious about how this potential project and ones like it are translating into reduced cost of energy, but at the same time, how is the PCE?
Stupid question.
Oh, I did I really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm curious how the PCE then offsets the savings in the ecosystem of being able to help people pay for their energy at this point. So I'm kind of curious about that cost of energy, the PCE impact when it nets back out again. And then you mentioned in here a 10-year payback of the project. I'm curious, who is that paying back in that 10 years, or is that just kind of giving us an order of magnitude understanding of the savings? So sorry for kind of a compound question there.
I'll do my best to answer on a couple of fronts. And I guess the 10-year payback is really a perspective of what the savings would be and, referencing what the cost of fuel is, that by saving that much fuel over 10 years, we can regain the cost of the project. So who benefits from that? Because this project is owned and operated by AVEC, we would be reducing the fuel cost for all the consumers in GVAC. If you recall, the Power Cost Equalization Program only applies to residential consumers and community accounts. So not only is there a reduction for those consumers, but there's also a reduction for the commercial accounts, the school. There's not really any industry in GVAC to speak of, but there are significant commercial accounts in that community. And they would see a reduction in their energy costs because that, going back to that graph that shows that, more than half of the energy cost is typically fuel. If we're reducing that fuel component by half, we're bringing down a large chunk of what the cost of energy is for that community. So the savings goes directly to the people in the community. Now, the power cost equalization obviously is looking at the total cost of power in reference to the cost of power in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, and it buys down 95% of the difference. So the impact to the residential consumer after they receive PCE, it masks that large reduction in fuel costs because their costs for power may be going from 26 or 27 cents a kilowatt hour after PCE to maybe 24, 25 cents a kilowatt hour because there is that component of PCE paying down 95% of the difference. So there is quite a bit of benefit that actually flows through to the power cost equalization endowment because they are not spending the money to pay down a larger difference in cost. And the money that the state saves, or the money that the state is investing actually returns money to that power cost equalization program as well.
That going upstream from that. So whatever we're not paying on PCE is available for community assistance program. Whatever we have left over in the waterfall from that is less money that's coming from the general fund. It trickles all the way back up.
Right. And to follow up on that, but I'm also interested in whether Representative Rauscher wants to follow up if I stole part of his question. But part of I'm also trying to connect the dots is how do we do a better job of recognizing those savings that are going to the PCE endowment because it's not paying out. How could that be looked at in a way to help us fund more of these REF projects? Because these REF projects bring real dollars back into the PCE endowment, but the way it's kind of set up, there's a little bit of a disconnect on the benefit that comes out from that. I'm kind of picking away in different ways at that same problem of these seem like very investable projects, mm-hmm. but we seem to have a disconnect on being able to see the investability as a direct justification to put more money into doing more of these projects. Does that make sense?
That's our job with how we delegate UGF.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know whether Representative Rauscher wanted to follow up on the question I partially stole from him.
Well, thank you. Yeah, to the chair, I guess there's not much left, but let's just for a second so I could better understand this. If we go to slide number 4, so everybody looks at the pie chart. I'm just trying to understand all the different colors of blue so I don't get them mixed up because that's part of the question in some respects. 59%, 2%, and 2% are different shades of blue. I just want you to let us know which is which for sure.
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I apologize for the, yeah, and it could, I'm sure trying to match color for color is difficult, but it does map. If you start at the top of the list, that is the largest component. And then if you work clockwise around the pie chart and work down that list, that would represent the...
Okay. Well, thank you for the clarification. So I guess just to, piggyback on somewhat of what... Representative Holland had talked about, and we're talking about percentages now of AVAC's total revenue, and what percentage does PCE play in that total revenue that you get from your what percentage does it play?
I didn't provide it in this slide, but I do have another presentation slide with pie charts. And about half of the services that AVEC provides power to are commercial and school and industrial accounts.
Which are exempt, yeah.
Which are exempt, and about half are residential, commercial, community and street lighting and those sorts of things. Of those, not everything is eligible due to either population caps or kilowatt hour caps on a monthly basis. So in the end, it's not 50% PCE supported. It's only 20% of total revenue is reimbursed by PCE.
So thank you. And so then I guess the end would be if we're talking about the project versus what you have now versus what you should have in the end, is the project just saving fuel cost, or is the project saving more than just the fuel cost, and in what respect will it actually save?
I believe, through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I believe that the primary benefit is the reduction in fuel cost. As I mentioned, there is a component in there that is a reduction in operation and maintenance costs for the diesels. The less we run the larger units or the less we run units in general, it would reduce our operation and maintenance for those items. But it also does provide improved power quality. The battery remains on the system the whole time.
Right.
It holds a much tighter frequency and voltage stabilization, and it is always there to pick up some of those dips in the power supply and prevent outages.
All right, well, I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Any further questions? Co-Chair Holland?
Great. Thanks. One more question. I just was curious, as these power projects come on and you've increased the ability of the wind and solar projects to displace not only diesel fuel, but at times the use of the large diesel plants, so you're using the smaller ones, are we actually reducing the total number of diesel gensets that are in these communities? So we're reducing the O&M and the ongoing cost of the diesel facilities? Or are we still at a point where, despite getting off of diesel fuel, because we still need all the backup capability, we're still essentially running most, if not all, of the same number of generators in all these rural communities and all the costs associated with them? I believe you noted that I think there was about 160 generators, 160 and 46 power plants. I'm just curious, is that 160 number coming down? Is it staying the same because we're still kind of stuck? Any thoughts on that and how we might get to accelerating the actual retirement of diesel gensets and all of the costs that go with them?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Holland, it's an unfortunate fact that I think it's item B. We are still maintaining quite extensive amount of diesel infrastructure, and it's not just the diesels themselves. It's one of the items, one of the underpinnings of rural Alaska is fuel storage. Obviously, we only get fuel when the barges are floating, typically, unless you're flying in fuel. So there are extensive diesel tank farms, and it would be foolhardy for any utility to say, well, we've got wind or we've got solar, we don't have to fill our tanks this year. So we still maintain full storage and full generation capability to handle an entire year or, you know, 14 months worth of generation to the best of our ability. It's nice when we don't have to put as much fuel in the tanks every year, but we still don't rely on the wind to blow or the equipment to stay operational to the point where we can start deleting diesel generation resources at this point. There may be other technologies, you know, I think hydro might be a little bit more reliable, but still, if you've only got one turbine in the hydro stream and it breaks, it takes a while to fix things in rural Alaska. And if it's a one-off installation or whatever, it can take longer than your backup supply is. So AVEC's position is to continue to maintain the full breadth of our generation capacity, and we're really looking at the benefit of reducing diesel dependence and diesel use.
Thank you, Mr. Stamm. I'd imagine that with the O&M costs, a large part of that is just taking care of stuff just because it exists, but also there'd be the ability to reduce some O&M by reducing the run hours on the generators.
Yes. The less times we spend those internal combustion engines, the less maintenance we have on them. The less oil we have to put in them, the less filters we have to put on, the less overhauls, tune-ups, it all adds up.
And the longer it'll be before we have to replace them. Thank you very much, Mr. Stamm. Are there any final thoughts from anyone before we wrap up today?
Senator
Rauscher?
I just want to thank all the presenters today. It was very interesting. Thank you very much. I thought they spent a lot of time and building some of these slides and giving us a presentation of what their future looks like and why they're heading where they're heading and why they felt the need to go there. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it as well. We've got a couple of dozen projects on the REF list and getting to look a little bit more in depth with different scales and types of projects I found very helpful, and I appreciate that was shared by others. All that being said, thank you one last time for everyone that came today. The House Energy Committee will not be meeting next week. We'll continue our individual conversations with folks as we develop some bills. and move on to the next phase of the committee as we move on with our legislative session here. Our next scheduled hearing will be announced through committee email. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 2:58 p.m.